It's episode 454, and today I'm chatting with Sarah Ann Macklin. Let's cue that intro.
The big question is this: how do we use cycling as a tool to improve our health, our happiness, and our longevity? That is the question, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Anthony Walsh, and welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Roadman, welcome back to another Roadman Cycling Podcast. Thanks for joining me. You're going to absolutely love today's conversation. I'm joined today by Sarah Ann Macklin. You know the frequency of a podcast that I put out. It's relentless. It's 6 days a week. But every now and then I get a podcast that just feels like, it feels like why I initially started the podcast. I had this weird concept when I started the podcast that a podcast should be voyeuristic. It should be you sitting in a cafe or a bar and getting to eavesdrop on a conversation I'm having with someone. Sometimes, because people know they're being interviewed, podcasts feel a little bit rigid and it doesn't feel like that natural conversation, but that is definitely not the case today. Maybe it's because Sarah is the host of the brilliant podcast, The Be Well Collective, which I thoroughly recommend you check out. I'm going to link that in the show notes for today. That's just roadmancycling.com/show notes/454. If you don't know who Sarah Ann Macklin is, she's a former model turned nutritionist and podcaster, and she's on a mission to make nutrition relevant to everyone. The science of what we eat, it affects how we feel, it affects how we think, and it affects how we perform, but it also has huge long-term ramifications for our health. This is a drum I beat, you know, practically every single episode on the podcast. We are what we eat. But today's interview is particularly interesting and relevant to us as cyclists because we're constantly chasing that kilogram less. We're constantly saying to ourselves, okay, I'll be happy when I get to this weight. But although modeling and cycling are two very different industries, we definitely have common problems within this. This idea of chasing a mirage. The Stoics call it the hedonic treadmill, chasing something in the distance. And that's what we explore in depth today, the link between food and how that makes us feel and how we view ourselves. It's a fascinating chat. So please welcome to the Roadman Cycling Podcast, the amazing, the beautiful, the inspirational Sarah Ann Macklin.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Sarah, I had to press record because we were in danger of using up our whole allotted time there just talking before I even pressed record.
But you know what? That's a good thing for the podcast. At least we feel like we're going to have a lot to talk about because I have no idea about what you're going to ask me.
So. I never have an idea what I'm going to ask. I was a guest on a podcast a few weeks ago and he said to me, oh, would you like me to send you the questions before it? And I was like, I'm sure it's a normal enough request, but I was like, when I think about podcasts, when I'm a listener of a podcast, I want to be this voyeuristic person sitting at the bar listening to two people and listening to their conversation and eavesdropping on it. And I think that's the beauty of a podcast. And I was like, I don't want the questions sent to me. That's not like, I would never go to London and meet you for a coffee and then say to you in advance, here's what we're going to talk about when I'm on the coffee. It's just such an artificial construct.
So my podcast always want their questions beforehand and I have to be very like subtle. I'm only giving them maybe like one or two areas and then, but we always free flow. I think it's so much more and it's more organic, isn't it? When you just have a natural conversation.
Because I think your assistant or your PA reached out with like, what's the question? So I was like, no, we're just going to freestyle this one. And then they came back with like, oh, amazing.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to this.
I was listening to your TED talk, which everyone should listen to. It's really good. That must have taken a lot of practice in front of a mirror.
Do you know what? It was quite terrifying. I actually did a solo episode last week, actually speaking about my story, and I am quite dyslexic. So public speaking for me in the beginning days was terrifying because you always have this nervous energy that you're going to mess up your words or you're not going to pronounce something correctly or and also especially in a TED talk you don't have any prompts, so it's remembering a 20-minute talk, and originally it was half an hour, and then halfway through the TED process they were like, actually no, now it's 18 minutes. And so all of a sudden a few weeks before you had to kind of cut half your talk out, and trying to get all your points in 18 minutes is actually quite difficult. Try to tell a story, but
it's very, very hard. That's, I think, the biggest challenge is the shorter duration time. I think Mark Twain has a saying of, I didn't have time to write you a short letter, so I wrote you a long one.
Yeah. Okay. But it's true. You always, do you ever remember, I know that you went to university, but do you ever remember at university when you tried to get down your word count or at school? And it was probably the most stressful part of the whole essay, was trying to cut half your words out. And it's true, trying to make sure it's succinct and to the point is a really good talk. But yeah, no, it was a very, it was a really good memorable experience. Probably one of my first public speaking engagements. So.
And you were amazing at it. And you've the beautifully polished British accents, which everyone in Flanders appreciated.
Well, yeah, I would say I definitely perfected how I used to speak. I was never the best speaker. I was always so worried about my words and the formulation of words. And sometimes, I mean, I was speaking to a friend last night and literally the whole sentence came up backwards. And they were like, what did you say? Just like, that's just how my brain sometimes works.
But my insecurity around the podcast initially was because very soon you start looking at your downloads, you're like, oh my God, somebody in like Zimbabwe downloaded the podcast. It's like, oh my God, someone in South Africa's listening. And then you're like, oh my God. But in Ireland, in the native Irish language, which I don't speak, but I just can only guess that it's a like a genetic default that we have for a genetic bug or something, we don't pronounce the TH when they're back to back together. So this is why, like, you hear the Americans when you're in a bar and they're like, oh my God, you're Irish, say 33 and a third, because there's so many THs in it and we can't pronounce them. So I literally can struggle to differentiate between T-R-E-E and T-H-R-E-E. So I'm like, oh, this is going to be so obvious on the podcast. But I find myself manicuring the sentence so I don't have to use the word and trying to navigate around it.
You should, you know, that should be, I think that's fantastic. I think, you know, that should be kind of like your USPs. It's different. You should be distinct to how, you know, the formulation should be. That's you. It's great. I remember one friend I had, I've got lots of friends who are Irish, but one of them, I would always, because I'm awful at accents, and I, during my career at one point, got signed to a big acting agency, and my downfall was that I could never do accents well. So I was always very good at like the typical British accent, but trying to make me do any other accents was just an absolute nightmare. I failed all the time. And I remember my Irish friend was saying, try and say power shower. And that was the one that actually got me into the Irish accent.
I feel like we'd need to get some drinks into you for you to start trying a few accents live on air.
Anyone needs to hear that.
Listening to your TED Talk, what I was struck with was, so my background really briefly, I went through law school. So I had 7 years of law school, qualified as a lawyer, and then as I should have been heading out into the world as a lawyer, much to the disappointment of my parents, I decided to pursue a career as a professional cyclist. So I moved to France, and I went into France, and listening to your TED Talk, the similarities in the initial beginnings of the journey, you going to Milan and you're thrown into basically squalor straight away, where you're like dealing with rats and you're dealing with, you know, very little disposable income, social isolation, and probably the language isolation as well. I'm not sure if you speak Italian, but for me that was a huge one. How hard was that experience, you know, kind of chasing your dream of being a model early?
So hard, and I found it a really difficult one to talk about, actually, because when I was doing my TED Talk, and for any listeners who have no idea of my background, I started as a model, and through my own journey, I transitioned into a nutritionist and then started a charity to support mental health and physical well-being. And it was when I wanted to give my TED Talk, a lot of it wanted to be based around nutrition, but I knew I had to tell my personal story. And the hard thing is, you get judged the second you're on stage. And there was this terrifying moment where I was like, they're going to think that you're a model and everything's fine and everything's easy, and they're just going to completely switch off. And it's that horrible thing where you don't want to say poor me, but it's that actually when you are 16 and you're just like kind of plopped into a city on your own, it's quite terrifying. And you're not really an adult at that. Well, you're not an adult at that point.
Yeah.
So it's trying to take yourself back to being the age of 16 and this happening. And it was terrifying because 1 year I didn't speak a language. I also had nobody there that I trusted because I was just completely new. I mean, you have an agency in that country, but you don't know them. It's, you know, you've just met them for the first time.
You're probably just another number to them.
You're a commercial asset. And if you don't work as that commercial asset, then you're gone within literally a couple of weeks. And the difference back then as well, there was no iPhones. I mean, I think I had a Nokia, but I mean, I remember I had the pay as you go. So
well, I think we're roughly the same vintage, because I had this exact same experience as well, where you're trying to navigate off, you know, some credit on your mobile phone at some point, but there was no maps.
There was no maps. So I would sit in my room every night trying to figure out where all these addresses are, 18 addresses over Milan, and how I would get the metros there, and if you'd get lost that you actually couldn't use your mobile because then it didn't work abroad at some points. And so there was this whole loneliness aspect to it. But back then, you know, it was never spoke about. I mean, we speak about mental health quite broadly today, which I think is fantastic. But I think when you're quite young, trying to navigate mental health is, for me, it just wasn't available. I didn't even really know what that term meant. So the loneliness aspect was a huge one, but it's only something I came to realise kind of later on as I developed my career that actually that was quite a harrowing part of the early stages. But you do kind of just accept it. I don't know if you had that when you moved to France, but you kind of just accept that situation rather than actually thinking, is this right? Is this how I should be feeling? You just kind of accept it and go, well, you know, life's tough, just get on with it. And you just get on with it.
Yeah, I remember what I struggled with, I think it was a lot, was the difference between what the reality friends thought I was living, or their perception of my reality, and the actual reality I was living. I was journeying back through some old diaries a while ago, and I've always liked writing. And I remember a few years after living in France, I'd signed for a professional team in the US. And which sounds amazing, but it's tragic and it's horrible, because the US is absolutely vastly bigger than definitely Ireland and the UK, but even Europe. So there's so much traveling involved. So you could be on a bus for 17, 18 hours and then expected to get off and race your bike against people who have, you know, flown there. So we were quite a low budget team. But I remember one day, and I had to get four buses to get into the city centre from where I was living in Toronto, and then I was going to get two buses from Toronto to Chicago, which was roughly 9 hours. But my door-to-door trip was going to be like 15 hours till I got into my accommodation. Wow. And I was sitting in the back of this bus, and I was crammed in between two really overweight people, and they were like stinking, like really stinking. And I was like almost gagging, and I was like, got a text off a friend, and it just said, so jealous, you're living the dream. And I was like, what dream am I living? Like, this is horrible. I hate my life right now. And when I started taking a paycheck for riding the bike, that was such a weird transition, because I went from doing something that I loved that brought me a lot of happiness to a job. And now I had to do this, because this was like almost inseparable from who I am. What I do and who I am became the same thing. And I always had, okay, I am a lawyer, but what I do for fun is cycling. And then I took that paycheck and it changed everything for me, and it wasn't the dynamic I enjoyed.
I think it's just so important to actually realize that you can get paid for what you love. And that is, I mean, it just shows so much, you know, courage from you to do that, because I think it's easier said than done. And I think many people can come on and share their personal experiences, but it's never easy in that moment. You know, people look at people who have managed to make their career and from their passion, but it's never that easy leap. There's always so much struggle, and there's a lot of courage, and there's a lot of moments of financial stress and financial worry. And I think that's a really big thing that I always find it really hard to talk about my journey, because there's part of me that kind of thinks, oh, does anyone really want to listen to this? Is anyone really that interested? But actually, I think, you know, even, you know, listening to your story, is it's so important to talk about that transition period, because there is so much unpredictability. And I think for so long, you're on a flat slope, that's related to cycling, and then all of a sudden, my small knowledge that I have, but then all of a sudden you reach that peak. And then you start seeing things rolling quite quickly. But there's that whole like middle transition slope period where there is just flat ground. And for that sure is the real struggle. And I think, you know, it is really important to talk about that, because that transition period is, there's so much anxiety around that. As you said, financial side is a huge one. When I left modelling, and I managed to make a successful career, but then I really wanted to transition into nutrition. I mean, walking away from contracts and like living in New York and all that, all those years that I took to build up my career to then go, actually, I'm now going to go into something when nobody really knows what a nutritionist is 10 years ago. It's not cool. There's no money in it. I go in at a £20,000 ban in the NHS.
But I think it was important that you shared your backstory. When I remember starting the podcast and I got into really deep on storytelling and the storytelling arc. And the backstory, I'm sure you dug into a lot of this for your TED Talk, but the backstory is super important. If you ever watch a movie and the hero dies at the end of the movie and you're like, I literally don't care that he's dead. I have no attachment to this hero.
You're not empathetic to him.
Yeah, because they haven't done enough of a good job building the hero's backstory. And a book I read on this was called Save the Cat. And that's what the filmmakers call it, where it's like Mark Wahlberg saves the cat in the early scene. And you go, oh, Mark is a good guy. And then later on, you care about the outcome of this grand battle that he's fighting. When I was listening to your TED Talk, I immediately identified with the struggle you had in Milan. And I was like, oh, I really do care about how this turns out for Sarah. Mm. Does she go on and make it in nutrition? Does she make nutrition cool? Does she start solving some of the problems she set out to solve? So I think that's a nice segue for us to go into what you kind of set out to do within nutrition, because we're often told, and whether it's bike rider or model, you need to look a certain way, you need to be a certain weight, but we're not given a blueprint for how to get there. But I feel like as well, for the general listener who probably isn't a professional bike rider or probably isn't a professional model listening, they're still told to be healthy, you need to be healthy, but they don't have a blueprint to get there. And almost worse than the situation that we had to navigate, they have so much information fired at them. They've so many diets coming at them that it just feels overwhelming and a little bit hopeless. So like, what's their steps for starting to take control back and feel like, okay, there is a mountain to climb, but at least I know I'm climbing the right mountain.
It's that information overload, isn't it? And it's that navigating through that. And even for me, who studied nutrition and you know, been in clinical practice now for many years, I still sometimes go into a supermarket and feel overwhelmed. And I'm like, if I've got degrees in this and, you know, however many years of research, and I am overwhelmed, how is the average person who hasn't studied this going to navigate it? And I think that's really important, because as a consumer, we are bombarded every day with information, and half of it isn't factually correct. And it's, how do you navigate that? And it's a big topic. I could talk about this for the whole podcast, because it's a really big one for me, because we're in this very weird moment in society where, when I started studying nutrition, one, it was about my own personal experience, but you know, there wasn't that much information when I started it. Nobody really spoke about nutrition. I mean, it wasn't a buzzword. Wellness hadn't even kind of come to the forefront, even though I hate that word because it's quite faddy, but it never came to the forefront. So for me, it was all about like looking at journals and trying to find evidence-based information. Now, it's quite hard to find the real core evidence-based information, because everybody is an expert, or everybody is talking about this, or there's a product coming out that's going to be a magic bullet. And it's very difficult to navigate that. And it also depends on what environment you're in. Where do you live? You know, in London, New York, you are around constantly, you know, new emerging products, new trends. But then if I go back to my parents' house, which is in Hampshire, you know, they don't have all this on choice. And so again, their choice is very limited to actually quite processed foods, convenience foods, things. So there's like a really kind of mixed market there. So I think it's really hard for anyone to navigate actually what are they meant to be doing, because we are bombarded day in, day out. So for me, I would say just to start is to actually just look into your shopping basket, whether it's online or whether it you actually go to supermarket, and actually see how much real food is in there. And
yeah, that I think sounds that's a great start.
It sounds such a boring answer to your question, but it's true, because I think many people will be so shocked by finding out that actually, probably, well, we know for stats, 2/3 of your supermarket baskets are full of processed foods. And it's actually trying to understand actually what is a processed food in there then, because a lot of people say, well, that's probably not processed, but it is. And so it's actually thinking how many real whole foods are in there, and that's, I think, the starting point for the journey into becoming a bit healthier, a bit more aware of what you're eating. Because we do live in a world where everything is made around convenience, because all of us are busy. And time, I think, is one of the most valuable assets we have. So we've basically made our lives into this convenience style, which I think is fantastic, but also it's becoming quite detrimental to our health at the same time. So the starting point, I would say, is look into your basket and how many real foods, whole foods, are in there. And that's the starting point. And then every time you go to the supermarket, I always say to my clients, try and add a new vegetable or whole food that you've not had before. So whether it's a specific type of legume, whether it's a specific type of fruit, a specific type of vegetable, pulses, whatever that is, add something new in that you've never tried before. And then slowly each week you'll be adding a new food in, and it doesn't feel that you're trying to make this huge lifestyle change in one go. And that has so many roll-on effects. You know, we know about our gut microbiome, we know how important diversity is, and so over time, slowly, it becomes more manageable and more accessible.
Yeah, you've hit on so many good points there, and one, like, there's a couple I want to grab a hold of and run with. But one of them, it's the quick fix culture we're in, and we're seeing this all the time, even in cycling right now at the moment. It went from intermittent fasting was quite popular, and, you know, I'm sure there's is some great benefits, you know, cellular autophagy, compressed feeding window, there is some great benefits to that, but I don't think it's a tool for everybody. A lot of this stuff is like a cherry on the top, where you need to build a proper foundation of, like you're talking about, are you eating like one food ingredients? But something that's super popular in cycling at the moment is ketone usage, and it's really on the fence of, is this is legal, but is this moral? Some cycling teams have even said, no, we're not endorsing the use of ketones. Now, maybe they're hiding sort of limited budgets behind it, and ketones are quite expensive, and it's financially makes sense for them to distance themselves from something they can't afford anyway. But it's, I'm seeing athletes even coming to me that are saying, you know, oh, do I need to use ketones? I'm like, there's, but like, maybe the answer is down the road, but have you done the 99 out of 100 things anyway that work? And I think we're definitely are in this culture. Like right now I'm wearing an Oura ring and it's tracking sleep and stuff.
I've got one.
Do you like it?
Yeah. I love it. I had a sleep expert on my podcast and I really wanted to talk about like biohacking and talking about all of these fantastic products. And obviously Matthew Walker, who wrote the book.
It's brilliant, yeah.
Which is fantastic. He's on the board of Oura now, and I was really interested. I think there's parts of it that I think resonate with allowing you to understand your routine and the importance of sleep. And sometimes, I mean, when I first got it, I actually started cancelling evenings because my sleep was quite poor the night before. And I was
you're fun to be around.
I know. I was like, this is actually quite a positive influence it's having on me. But I do think there is, you know, it isn't 100% accurate, but I think it's very good for putting in positive behavior patterns. So I am more aware of my sleep because of it. But I think it's just really interesting to understand a bit more. And it's got, I don't know how you find it, but it's got meditation things on there, breath work techniques on there. You just become a little bit more aware, I think, of your sleep. And I think that is important because it is one of the main pillars of the foundation. And I'm sure you know that being a cyclist and a sportsman.
So my issue with it is maybe that it's like, what do we do with the data? So I'm not sure what sports you practice at the moment. Are you, do you gym, yoga? Do you run?
I'm a runner. I'm not a cyclist. I'm like the gym spin person.
Okay. Or, that's the deal.
But I love running, and I've done that since I was young. Like long distance running.
So my issue with it is like, what do we do with that data? So we get it in the morning, and I suppose there's a couple of different scenarios when you open up your data. It's like the binary ones are helpful, but I already know the answer to those. Did I sleep really well or really bad? So then I can go, yes, I'm definitely going to train, or I'm definitely not going to train today. But most of the time, that's obvious. Like I went out a few weeks ago, I wouldn't be huge one for drinking, but my cousin was works in Ukraine with a charity, and he came back, and we ended up going out and having way too many beers in Dublin. So the next day I woke up, looked at my sleep data, and I was like, oh my God, I am fucked. Like I cannot train today. But like I knew that. I had a banging hangover. I'd only slept 4 hours. I'd loud music all night, And then other nights I wake up and I feel totally refreshed and I'm good to train. But the majority of the use cases are the middle ground between those two opposites. Mm. So it's now, okay, I slept kind of okay. I slept 70% or however we want to quantify it. But it's like, what do I do with this now? Because I have a session tonight where I'm meant to do 2x20-minute threshold efforts. Do I change those to 2x10 efforts? Do I change the intensity back a little bit? I think it's great that Aura is there, but I think the next application of it, it needs to move from just more information to something that's a little bit more prescriptive.
Yeah, I do agree. And I think there's pros and cons. Because I think I'm quite influential if I see that kind of data. And I am somebody who would push myself to go out. So I, even if I felt tired after those beers with a night out, I'd probably go, do you know what, screw up, I'm gonna train anyway, I don't care. Whereas if Aura, I mean, there was one time where I had like zero REM sleep. I was like literally off the charts and my sleep was so poor and it highlighted how bad my evening was. And at that moment I was like, actually, do you know what? I'm not going to do it. But I think I have a personality that I would push myself and I'm not as aware maybe as I should be. So I think in those moments, it's very good. I think it just starts creating that conversation. And I do agree it might need to be more specific. And they do say, you know, it's not as accurate as they wish it was, but we're definitely on this journey into understanding more around biohacking and using personalized data. But we are still such in the early stages of this, and I think that's something we need to recognize. We have to take it with a pinch of salt. You know, that data that you're seeing might not be completely accurate.
And I think the interesting part of it is tying in with a lot of the stuff that you're an expert in. It's where is the line? I don't think we can put stuff into self-contained little vessels and say, okay, this is nutrition, this is mental health, this is sleep. They're all very intertwined. Like, talk to me a little bit about the way how food influences the way we feel. Because I know this is something that really gets me, where I will, like, a new restaurant open down the road, and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go in and I'm just going to try the burger because it's a burger joint. And I'm like, I know it's not a good food, but I just try the burger. And then the moment of weakness, I also ordered a Sunday. Now, I'm not in a, you know, I'm not someone who's trying to lose weight. I'm at a weight I'm happy with and I have been there for a while. But I still, all that evening, it affects my mood that I've made that food choice. Talk to me about how, is there cognitive pathways or how does this come about?
Gosh, again, this could be a whole podcast. This is something I'm really passionate about because it's something I went through. And if we look at, I mean, it all starts really in our gut microbiome. This is where we know so much research is around the food and the mood link. So that's why we always call, you know, our stomach the second brain, because it generally is. I mean, this is where all of our neurotransmitters are made. So our serotonin, our dopamine, all of these neurotransmitters that make us feel good, they're mainly made, 90% of them, in our stomachs. And so within our gut microbiome, if we have a poor gut microbiome diversity, this does affect how we feel. Alongside that, you're taught, I mean, just from resonating from what you've had, the Sunday, really high in sugar. So again, that's going to be impacting your insulin. We know that also has an effect on how you feel. Because as soon as you go up with your blood glucose, you go down quite quickly. And then your brain is wanting, it's kind of like crack for the brain, it's wanting that injection again. So it wants to go back up on that trajectory. So all of these dimensions really impact how we feel. Alongside that, it's also going to impact your sleep. And so when you put these all together, it's very hard to succinctly say, well, this equals this. They all combine together, as you said, and they all have an impact on one another. And then if you sleep poorly, again, we know that our hormones start reacting the next day. So ghrelin, our hunger hormone when we're tired, starts increasing these carbohydrate cravings again. And so you kind of get on this cycle where sometimes people, they can't get out of that cycle. And that's why, because all of these behaviors are entwined. So looking at our diet overall, but also looking at our sleep, looking at how much lux we're getting, like the light from outside, is really important. And when you combine all of these aspects together, you start to overall feel better. But it's very hard, as you said, just to take fragments of these and think, okay, well, actually, if I don't have that, I'll feel fine. It's actually the foundation is working them together. And if we're not eating the food that is nourishing ourselves from the inside, it's going to be having a dramatic effect on how we feel. And I always try to put it as the analogy. Imagine that you're driving a petrol car. and you start putting diesel in it, sooner or later you're going to start, well, very quickly you're going to start encountering problems that it's not running correctly. Yeah. And that's the same with our bodies. You know, our bodies aren't meant to be having all of this processed food all the time. It doesn't get the nutrients and the vitamins that we need for it to work how it's meant to work. And so if we're constantly bombarding it with, you know, nutrient depletion, which if we look at stats today, you know, we are in an obesity, and I don't use this word lightly, but an obesity epidemic. We really are at that point.
So what's classified as obese for somebody?
So, well, let me just say, so if we're obese, but we are also at a massive risk of malabsorption from a nutrient deficiency. So we are overeating, but we're nutrient deficient.
Yeah.
Which, when we think about that, is the other end of the spectrum. We normally think somebody who's nutrient deficient doesn't eat, doesn't consume enough. But actually, on the other end, we are obese, but we're also nutrient deficient. And that's quite a worrying place to be in, because it means that the food that we're consuming is not the correct food. And so...
it's such a complex problem, Sarah Ann, isn't it? It's like, because we have society set up, you know, post-industrial revolution, which is a way that isn't particularly serving our movement or our food needs. People are heading out the door, stuck in traffic typically, a long day at the office, they're coming home. They've had decision-making fatigue after a long day of making decisions all day. And then the final nail in the coffin is the rush hour commute home, and they get back to their house and now it's like 7 o'clock in the evening. And yeah, maybe they know the right thing to do, but on the other hand, they have marketing and powerful sales machines pushing a message that isn't serving them. You know, you just need to turn on any channel on the TV or the radio, and I'm not sure about where you are in London, but here in Dublin you're bombarded with Deliveroo messages straight away. You turn on your phone, it's Deliveroo, Deliveroo. Like, Deliveroo isn't bringing you anything good. Like, most of the time, there's some outlier cases, but if you go with the Deliveroo option, so...
But I also don't think people really know what the right choice is, because I think there's so many products marketed as healthy. I mean, look at children's cereals that are marketed as healthy, but they're sugar bombs. And I think that's the worrying part. Even the Eat Well plate, you know, so much within that Eat Well plate is processed foods.
Well, orange juice cracks me, like, because it's like, hold on.
Bagels that are put in there. I'm kind of, you know, I'm not saying that white bagels are poor, but I would say, you know, where's the whole food produce? Where's more of the real organic produce? Where's the legumes? Where's the pulses, the ones that aren't processed? You know, this is the information that we're relaying as Public Health England. And then you also have on top of that, you then have all of these huge manufacturers that are marketing like granola bars as really healthy. And actually, funny enough, I went to do a recording of a podcast yesterday, and it was quite an early morning start and I didn't have time to grab breakfast. And I thought, I'll grab maybe some fruit, a banana or some porridge en route. And I went into a coffee shop and I said, do you have any fruit or anything healthy that I can grab? And she went, oh yeah, there's all these great granola bars and muffins. And this was basically how people believe the food is healthy. And it's not. That is the same as probably eating, you know, a chocolate bar in the sugar content. There's so much misinformation around healthy produce.
And isn't the hard part when somebody thinks they're eating well? Like, I was in a similar experience in insomnia here, and the person on front of me had got one of these protein bars. But like, it just says the word protein. If you're to flick over the macros on it, you know, there's as much sugar in it as there is in a Snickers. So they have that, and they have a natural squeezed orange juice. And they have the two of those, and they're going to the counter, feeling a little bit smug with themselves, thinking, I made the good choice here. But in reality, it's a terrible choice.
Well, that's the thing. And I think that's what's quite heartbreaking about the whole situation is we're always putting so much pressure on that individual. But it's the obesogenic environment that we are around, the choices that we are around. And so much we speak about free choice and, you know, it's down to your choice and your decision to be healthy. But we are not in an environment that is bred to be healthy and choice. We don't walk out. Not everybody has this luxury of walking out into a beautiful farmer's market every day with all this delicious fruit and vegetables surrounded by them. Hardly anyone does. We're actually in a supermarket where 80% of the supermarket is full of processed foods that are having, you know, specific special buys on for £1. If you buy this pack of crisps for £1, you know, these multi-buy deals. And that is actually the choice that we're giving. The choice isn't these beautiful unprocessed foods that we're seeing every day. And I think that's the really sad part of it. You know, even people that go to the gym, the protein shakes that they're having, you know, they're still processed. They still have so much caffeine in, sugar in, all of these things that we think as consumers are really healthy. But when we flick over the label, like, how much of that ingredients do you recognize, do you understand?
Okay, and here's the scary part. So this is, get ready to have your mind blown. This is my own personal conspiracy theory on Oura Rings. So you know the way we go to the supermarket, and it's been designed like this for years. It's nothing new. It's tactical that as your willpower is worn from making decisions through the shop, they put the easiest to consume, like normally chocolate bars, candy bars, stuff, close to the till. So you make a bad decision when you're close to the end of your shopping. You're sitting in the lineup waiting to get your groceries checked out. All the candy bars and sweets are there. So my theory where the dangerous side of Oura Ring and Whoop is, there's enough data on the app to show us when we're fatigued, when we're likely to make bad decisions. And then at those points, we get targeted with Facebook ads, with Google ads to make bad decisions. That's a place I can see it going in the not too distant future.
That is interesting.
And if someone hasn't built that product, I do want some credit for that product that I just created.
You're going to get your equity from now. It's hard, isn't it? It's really, there's so much about me as an individual that wants to believe that we are really good as human beings. But when you flip the other side, there is so much around money and, you know, the business side of things about making money and consumerism that is actually detrimental to the human being. Honest and good. And sadly, that's, I think, where the business side comes in. I think if we look at that and we flip it to today and we look at who sponsors the Olympics, who sponsors the FA Cup, I mean, McDonald's are the main sponsors for the Olympics. That is just, and Heineken, and all of these brands where for you as a sportsman, nutrition is so important to your performance. Sleep is so important to performance. But the sponsors of these big games and the Olympics are fast food brands and alcohol brands. And I just think the messaging there is, it's just the irony behind it is mad. That's actually what we are advertising as a sport, that so much on your performance goes on how you look after yourself. And sadly, it's the same in the modeling industry, it's the same in the fashion industry. You know,
words of messaging are just, they're so important, and people overlook how important words of messaging are. There's a legal saying, and it's a Latin saying that's translated into English as, it's talking about bias and how we need to avoid bias or the perception of bias at all times. So it's justice must not just be done, the justice must be seen to be done. And I think about this with the messaging around the food industry all the time, and I think about it, you know, whatever side of the COVID vaccine debate you were on, I think about it then when I see the CEO of Moderna on Sky News or on CNN talking about how somebody needs a third or a fourth injection, and I'm like, maybe he's correct, but it's like justice must not just be done, it must be seen to be done. If there's any smell of bias, we can't be getting our information from people who have vested interest in the outcome. It's like me going to the barber shop and asking them, do I need a haircut?
I mean, this is the biggest thing that I have as a scientist is research bias. And you see it in health a lot. You don't just see it in manufacturing, you also see it in documentaries. And so there is quite a lot of famous documentaries around health, like What the Health is one of them, and Game Changers is another. And when these came out, these were a huge talking point to many people. And lots of people wanted to go vegan. People were really angry against the meat industry. But what I watched when I saw that as a scientist was all the cherry pick evidence. And so if I wanted to make a documentary about how fantastic meat is, and you know, I don't eat meat, so I'm not saying that that's what I advocate, but I wouldn't go out and cherry pick all the evidence that showed how fantastic meat was, because believe me, there's a lot of evidence around that. And there's a lot of evidence around how bad meat is for us. But, you know, being a good scientist and a good researcher and a good, even creating a good documentary around that, is trying to not prove your hypothesis right. But what these documentary people did is try to show that their hypothesis and their thoughts were correct. And so they actually gave out to the consumer all of the evidence that they wanted to show. They didn't show the other side. And there is so much research bias around that. And that is something that I find very infuriating when I read specific articles or watch specific documentaries, that I think they are highlighting really important points, but they're showing one side.
But we're in an era of suspended logic. It's science and law, very similar. Like, I would create a legal hypothesis, and then I would do everything I can to attack that from as many different angles and disprove the hypothesis that I've arrived at as possible. Mm-hmm. Everybody just wants to say, okay, well, this is the way, and now let me find all the evidence to confirm the bias I've already arrived at. And exactly. It's a dangerous place.
Yeah. You always know if somebody is trying to disprove their hypothesis, that, you know, they're a good scientist. They really want to try and disprove their hypothesis. But so many times, all of these documentaries or, you know, people or voice of power try to prove it and are trying to constantly show that, that their thoughts are correct. And I think we kind of need to flip that on the other side and try to say, well, actually, let's look at all the angles that could disprove this. And then you're showing a very balanced way of presenting evidence and information. So I always say that's really important when anyone's watching any type of documentary. Try to be aware of, you know, how influential is this? Are they actually looking at the whole scope of evidence here?
So I've just come up with a hypothesis in my head, and I want you to disprove it for me.
Okay.
So Katie Taylor is the most famous Irish athlete in the world at the moment. She's really put female boxing on the map. So Katie defended her world title a few weeks ago, and coming up to the fight, she fights in a certain, I'm not sure how big a boxing fan you are or anyone listening, so I'm oversimplifying it. So there's a certain, there is a certain weight that Katie needs to achieve to be able to fight in that division. So okay. We'll just say, I don't know what weight she is. Let's say she's 130 pounds. Mm-hmm. So Katie normally probably walks around that. Again, these are totally fictitious figures, just to illustrate the point. Katie probably normally walks around at 145, 150 pounds. And then as she gets close to the fight, she has to go on a massive weight cut to make 130 pounds. And then she fights, and then we celebrate her as this amazing champion, which she is. She's such an inspirational woman and, you know, such a role model for so many people. But we celebrate that victory. And then we have on the other side, Kim Kardashian, who goes on a massive crash diet to get into a dress for an event. My hypothesis, there's no difference. We load and we criticize Kim Kardashian for endorsing crash diets, and we celebrate Katie Taylor for the exact same crash diet. That event is Kim Kardashian's world title fight. There's no difference. Disprove my hypothesis.
So I put Kim Kardashian in my TED talk, actually. So I have a very mixed views about this. I can see the point. I can understand that they're both really unhealthy behaviours. So anyone crash dieting in that short amount of time, especially like Beyonce when she did that maple syrup and lemonade, I'm not sure what it was, maple syrup drink, where she tried to lose loads of weight in 5 days for the same reasons. Not healthy, not good. But the difference I think there is, you've got a global icon, probably one of the biggest celebrities globally in the world, who has so much influence on young adults.
Are we talking Katie or Kim?
Kim.
Okay.
Katie, again, global icon, but more in a specific area. I think she probably only advocates that to win her fight, but then she'll go back to a very healthy way of eating. Kim Kardashian makes skinny lollipops to make you lose weight. It's all around how she looks, her aesthetics. You know, there's so much around how it's all based on how she looks. Katie is trying to base it on her performance. And sadly, like a model, sometimes you have to get into a very small outfit. Like a jockey, you have to be a specific way to ride. Same as a fighter. There's same as a sports racer, you know, Formula One. Yeah. You've got to be a specific size. They're trying to reach a specific goal, but they're not doing it for aesthetic purposes. And I think when you have a very young, influential audience following you globally, and you are advocating weight loss as an aesthetic view because you want to get into a smaller dress and you're openly doing it and talking about it, that's very detrimental. So I think there's two different ways. She's trying to do it for one specific performance to reach a title, but she's not advocating it as a healthy way to do it. She's probably saying, like, this is what I have to do to legally get into this race. I'm not saying that everybody should be doing this to get into a dress. This is what I have to do to perform and to get into that category. Kim Kardashian is advocating it as, I want to look really skinny in this dress with my waist, and this is how I'm going to look really glamorous, and this is how I'm going to do it. And the young influential audience that are following her automatically go, oh, well, I want to do that for next weekend, or I want to do that to go to a wedding, or I want to do that because that's what Kim Kardashian does and she's my role model. And I think the two different types of categories that are following that.
Yeah, I think you've disproved my hypothesis. Really important. But I wonder sometimes that we get hung up on sustainability and everyone's like, okay, that diet's not sustainable. But sometimes I think, well, it doesn't have to be sustainable. Like, I don't need to do it for the next 20 years. It's like, is saving 80% of my paycheck sustainable? No, absolutely not. But is it okay to do that for a short period of time to save a deposit for a house? Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll all agree that's a healthy practice. So I think sometimes the pendulum has swung very far in the direction of sustainability at the moment, where often I think that, and we can use this analogy for even what me and you do in the podcasting space, I think there's seasons to everything, and there's seasons to creation, and there's seasons to your physique as well, where it's okay to, you know, indulge a little bit over Christmas, and it's okay to be a little bit stricter over the summer, or it's okay to go inward in your creative journal and travel and not put out content so you can come back and bloom in a different season.
I completely agree. I actually had this conversation last night with someone about, and I don't know if you do this on your podcast, I don't know if you ever do or ever have done seasons in your podcast, but it's a big debate where you look at someone like Tim Ferriss or, you know, certain podcasters, the Huberman Lab, who never would have a season. And for me, I feel like it's really important to do that because I need creativity and space to go away and go, I really want to plan my next execution of my next series. Who do I want to get on there? What have I not talked about before? And you need that creativity and that mindset to actually step back and take some time for yourself to deliver some really good results. It's the same when people don't take a break in anything that they're doing. When do you have time to reflect and reset? And I think that is such an important conversation because I definitely have the pressure of posting every day on social media or delivering content every week, delivering a podcast every week. There's certain things that you feel, but you actually put that pressure on yourself. Because if you said, do you know what, I'm going off for 2 weeks for a holiday, I'm sure all of your listeners of this podcast would be like, okay, great, well, I'll just tune back in when he gets back. But you probably put a lot of pressure on yourself by thinking, gosh, no, I need to make sure that I am sticking to my word, delivering it every week, you know, honoring what I'm putting out there.
Because I'm 6 days a week as well, so that pressure is like, ah.
This is what I mean. And then when do you get a break? When do you actually get to like reflect and reset your mindset? And I am 100% sure that your listeners would go, completely get that, I'll just tune back in. Plus, he's got hundreds of episodes that I can catch back up on in those 2 weeks while he's away. So I think it's a really, really, I mean, I've completely just digressed off the sustainability comment, but I think it's really important to take the pressure off yourself.
Sarah, and, you're one of the guests that I could definitely do a 4-hour podcast with, no problem. I haven't covered a single question I set out to cover.
Well, we'll have to come back on.
Sarah, it's a plagiarized to end here. TED Talk. If you can't find a good role model, be a good one. Because you all can.
It's completely true. We're all role models to one another.
Sarah, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. This podcast really wouldn't be possible without our amazing listeners who have contributed to the running of this podcast since its inception over on Patreon. So thank you for everybody that has subscribed over there. You make this podcast possible. If you haven't subscribed yet, it takes about 60 seconds and it really keeps this show on the road. So you can head on over to patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. Buy me the price of a pint of beer once per month. It's not a lot to ask if you're getting value from the show. This works out at less than 25 cents per episode. So go to patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. And as always, on anything I mention on the show, the link is in the show notes.